Our next speaker is Dr. Sahar Hamid, and her presentation is entitled Youth and Women's Leadership, Cyber Activism, and the Arab Spring, Prospects for Political and Social Transformation in Contemporary Egypt. Dr. Hamid is Assistant Professor at University of Maryland, and where she is affiliated also as Professor of Women's Studies. Before that, she was head of the mass communication and information science at Qatar University, Qatar Doha. And her research interests focus on politics and media in the Middle East, new media, gender. And she is the co-author of the book Islam.com, Contemporary Islamic Discourses in Cyberspace. Please welcome Dr. Hamid.
Thank you. Pleasure and honor to be with you all this afternoon, and thank you very much to McGill University for this invitation. I hope this is only the beginning of a long-term collaboration. All right, so I chose to focus in my presentation this afternoon on youth and women's cyber leadership, cyber activism, and the Arab Spring, prospects for political and social transformation in contemporary Egypt. And by the way, just for your information, I am Egyptian myself, so that might help, I hope. So just to start with a very brief intro, and I always like to just set the floor first. So what is the Arab Spring in Arabic, al-Rabi al-Arabi? How many of you can actually speak and read Arabic? How many speak and read Arabic? Okay, oh, that's not bad. Okay, so that's al-Rabi al-Arabi or the Arab Spring. Of course, the term itself, Arab Spring, I personally prefer the term Arab Awakening because I feel the term awakening does have this strong and powerful effect. Somebody is waking you up, it means, you know, shaking you, really kind of changing your perspective on things and seeing things in a different light. It refers, of course, to the wave of political revolt that has been and still is sweeping the Arab region since 2011. By no means is it over. It is very much in the making and very much still going on in many parts of the Arab world. The next question is, where is the Arab Spring? And some visual image here might help, so I use this map, which I like a lot, because it does show the countries, actually, of the Arab Spring. It started, of course, in Tunisia, and as Laila has said, you know, with the act of Mohamed Bouazizi, who lit himself on fire and quite literally and metaphorically kind of, you know, sparked the whole movement or the whole rage that then spread to other parts of the Arab world afterwards. From Tunisia to Egypt to Libya to Yemen to Syria and to Bahrain, and one of my students in my course on Arab media in Maryland asked me, is there any particular logic behind this chronological sequence and this geographic sequence? I said, you know what, it's a good question. I cannot claim that I have an answer for it, but it might be a good, you know, thing to think about in future research. The next important question to ask is, who is the Arab Spring? And when I say who is the Arab Spring, it means the people, right? The people behind it. As Zainab mentioned, and I very much agree with her, it is always the people who are the key factors and the key players into all of this. Variation in age, gender, socioeconomic background, religion, and political affiliation. In other words, these movements were pretty much across the board. They were not about Copts or Muslims. They were not about men or women. They were not about rich or poor. They were very much everybody's movement and everybody's, you know, affiliation, everybody's input. Described as leaderless, well, I always take this term with a grain of salt. I do not take it for granted, and I even challenge it and argue with it, because, in fact, there have been a lot of activists. There have been a lot of work that has been done years and years and years before the eruption of the so-called, quote-unquote, Arab Spring or Arab Awakening. It is just that not very many of these movements here and there and these, you know, actions here and there have triggered this very large impact that we have seen in 2011. But that is not to say that there has been no activism, that there has been no organization. This is not true. A lot of these movements are the outcome of many, many years of activism, movements like Kifaya, which means enough, or the April 6th movement and other movements in Egypt and in other parts of the Arab world led to what we have seen in 2011 and paved the way for it. So what are the most important characteristics of the Arab Spring? If you were to just highlight some of the most important, you know, qualities or characteristics, we can say grassroots popular movements across the board, started peacefully, but violence and repression, unfortunately, were used by the regimes in power to coerce the protesters and to repress them. Significant role played by youth and significant role played by women, which is why I choose to focus on these two particular dimensions or demographic groups in my presentation this afternoon. Social media acted as catalysts for change and different outcomes in various countries, which is a point, again, that I agree with Zainab on, because not every country that had witnessed some of this Arab Spring movement had a similar result or a similar outcome. We have seen dictators being ousted in Libya, Tunisia, and Egypt. We have seen very, very violent outcomes in Libya. The loss of life there has been tremendous. Syria, of course, is an ongoing tragedy. The massive rape, the massive killing is just unbelievable. Yemen did not really reach the kind of outcome it was hoping for, and Bahrain is the forgotten revolution where people are shouting in the dark, which is the name of a famous Al Jazeera documentary. I would advise you to see it if you did not do so already. So these revolutions did not have one single outcome or did not result in the very same outcome. They have different outcomes in different countries. This is my favorite picture, and I think it is used also in the poster that we have for the event this afternoon. So what a coincidence, right? Mm-hmm. So really nice. So here, of course, this really shows the massiveness, right, and the magnitude of the popular uprising that has happened in Egypt from the heart of Tahrir Square, which is both literally and metaphorically the liberation square, so to speak, right? You see this, and this speaks, like we say in journalism, a picture equals a thousand words, or is even stronger than a thousand words, because a lot of these regimes have tried to misrepresent the movements as, oh, they're Asians, they're conspiring against the regimes, they're foreign Asians, they're paid by other governments, they're given KFC meals, as Zainab mentioned earlier this afternoon, right? But this is not true. These are not a handful of Asians, right? These are massive millions of people who went out there in the street, all sharing a very same agenda and having the very same goal and calling for the very same thing, which is for a dictator to be ousted from power. So where does cyber activism fit into all of this, right? The process of cyber activism being defined as how social media can be used to enact and bring about certain political and social outcomes and transformations. I love this picture. I just love it. I don't know how many of you saw it before, but I really am fond of it. Authoritarian regimes control the media, and they've been controlling it for many, many years in the Arab world before the inception of the Arab Spring. There has been a lot of heavy-handed, iron fist control of the media that, again, varies from one country to another. We cannot say it's the same degree of control, but we can say that overall there has been a lot of control over the media, especially broadcast media, in order to keep people in check and make sure they behave themselves and don't protest. But protesters found ways to spread information and calls for action. And here, I think this picture again, which speaks, it's stronger than a thousand words. If you see this Egyptian protester, and he's holding this banner, which has the word Egypt, right? But every letter in this particular picture, refers to one of the symbols on the internet, right? Internet Explorer, Google, Yahoo, I think this is PayPal, if I'm not mistaken, and Twitter, which is a very powerful and very strong image, how he wants to communicate that social media have played an important and prominent role in triggering the so-called revolution and Arab Spring in general, and the revolution in Egypt in particular. So why new media? Again, the word new, we can take it with a grain of salt. We can also think about some of the issues that Zainab raised earlier this afternoon, new versus old, new, relatively new. You can think about this as much as you want. But the fact is that new media accelerated the spread of information to a very wide audience, raised awareness about corruption and repression, mobilized and coordinated resistance on the ground, provided platforms for brainstorming, and also kept pressure on the regimes after the revolutions. And this is a very, very important thing to remember, because the work is not done. As we are clearly seeing in the case of Egypt, we'll talk about it in a moment, it's not like, hey, Mubarak is out of office, now our dreams are fulfilled and everybody can go to sleep and live happily ever after. Unfortunately, this is not the case. And I would like to just highlight the fact that different social media also play different roles. Facebook is best for networking because it can connect people together and they can share, you know, thoughts and ideas, and they can really kind of provide support for certain causes, you know, online, like the example of we are all Khaled Saeed, and we have seen other examples where people actually mobilize and network through Facebook. Twitter is best for on the ground, you know, calling for help, calling for action, calling for support. I'm being attacked now by the police. Please send, you know, help on the way. I'm being injured. I'm being harassed. You know, they're going to arrest me. Please do something about it. So it is best for on the ground, moment by moment, activism and organization. And there has been an interesting book called Tweets from Tahrir, which actually was like a moment by moment account of everything that has been happening in Tahrir Square as it unfolded through people tweeting to each other. YouTube, of course, is the best and most effective tool for documentation. As we have seen in the Syrian revolution, if it was not for YouTube videos that are uploaded all the time by activists, we will have no clue what is happening inside Syria, because the Syrian regime has actually banned international journalists and is not allowing any foreign journalists in the country. So if it was not for YouTube, we will have no way of finding out what's going on in Syria. So it plays an excellent role in terms of documentation. While blogs offer an excellent chance for brainstorming and exchange of thoughts and ideas. So I would say that different types of social media perform different roles and play different functions. But most importantly, their work is also not done. Just like the work of the activists and the protesters is also not done. Now it's time to keep the regimes, the new regimes, in check. Right? We have brought you to power, but guess what? If you don't fulfill what we are expecting you to do, we can also vote you out of office, and we can actually call for another revolution, which I think is a clear message the Egyptians have been sending to the new president, Mohamed Morsi. However, limitations of social media are also important to highlight, because while they may aid political change as catalysts and as mobilization tools, they are not magical tools. They are not magic, and they cannot bring about political change all by themselves. It is always the people themselves who can bring about actual change on the ground. In other words, in words like Facebook revolution, the YouTube uprising, the Twitter uprising, all of that has to be taken with a grain of salt and has to be, you know, flushed out and has to be controversially argued with. Because at the end of the day, if it was not for people like, you know, Khaled Saeed, people like Maryam Al-Khawaja, people like, you know, all of these great activists who actually risked their lives and went out in the street willing to face bullets and face tanks and face guns, no change can ever take place in the real world. It takes a lot of courage, it takes a lot of hard work, it takes a lot of commitment, and even paying the price of possibly facing death or torture or arrest to bring about actual change. So, the case of Egypt, which is the focus of this particular conference, from this, you know, broad or, you know, just overview of the Arab Spring in general and the role of social media in general, I'd like to now focus attention on the particular case of my beloved native country, Egypt. So, of course, there are so many different causes that led to the Egyptian revolution, 30 years of dictatorship and autocratic rule under Mubarak, corruption, the emergency law, which has been in place for a long time, curbing people's freedom and limiting the right to protest or go out in public places and take any kind of collective action, faulty constitution that gave the president unprecedented and unlimited powers, including the power to move on, you know, give power to his own son and therefore become some form of Republican, but also at the same time a republic, but a monarchy at the same time, which is like an odd, unheard of political system. Economic distress, unfortunately, with its, all of its historic and cultural wealth, Egypt is not economically wealthy. 40% of Egyptians live under the international poverty line, and I always say the sad joke that Egypt, in my opinion, is the richest country in the whole world because its rulers have been robbing it since more than 5,000 years ago, and it's still surviving. Amazing. Also, growing calls for constitutional, economic, political, and social reform. So all the time there is a call for having political, social, and economic reform. Forging the results of parliamentary elections. Of course, this has been going on for years. The 2005 parliamentary election in particular was, you know, there was a lot of forging going on, which led to people's anger. And I would also say that there was some successful model or example coming from the Tunisian revolution. When the Egyptians saw the example in Tunisia, they said to themselves, why not us? why not us? You know, Tunisia is a much smaller country. If they can do it, why couldn't we do it? So I think there was also some kind of, snowballing effect or ripple effect coming from Tunisia as well. So all of these factors, in my opinion, were causes behind the eruption of the Egyptian revolution. So what were the most important characteristics of this revolution? It charged the Egyptian people with a new sense of positivity, empowerment, determination, national pride, and solidarity. And, you know, all of us as Egyptians felt very, very proud, like never before, to be Egyptians, and there was this sense of national pride. A peaceful, youthful grassroots revolution that was very much across the board, involving different political, religious, and social groups. A unique leaderless revolution. Again, the word leaderless here should be taken again with, as I said, a grain of salt or some reservation, but, you know, there was no quote-unquote structure or structured leadership in place, not in a top-down model, but very much a grassroots, bottom-up approach of leadership. Solidarity, unity between Muslims and Coptic Christians, like never before we have seen Tahrir Square, where the very, very powerful, dramatic images of Muslims praying in the heart of Tahrir Square, being surrounded by, you know, their fellow citizens who are Christians, surrounding them and holding hands in order to protect them from the police forces. Very, very dramatic, very, very powerful images that show this kind of solidarity. Significant role played by young people, a significant role played by women, and signaled a new era of social and democratic reform. President Obama actually said, commenting on the revolution, Egypt will not go back to where it was before January 25th, 2011. And I very much share this passion, despite some of the bumps on the road and some of the difficult times and challenges that we are seeing these days in Egypt. But these were the most important characteristics that featured, in my opinion, or highlighted the Egyptian revolution. I would like to comment on the different communication strategies that were played out during the revolution, and especially to compare and contrast the strategies played by the government versus the strategies played by the young activists. For me, the comparison is very striking. That's why I wanted to highlight it. The government combined the suppression of protesters on the streets with the suppression of the truth through national state-controlled media. So one of my favorite moments was when I actually turned the satellite channels and looked at the coverage on Al Jazeera, where it actually showed people being, you know, hit and attacked, and stones are being thrown at them, and they're being tear gassed. And then you turn to the National Egyptian Television Channel, Channel 1, and you see the beautiful calm Nile, right? And all of a sudden it looks so romantic, and you feel that you are in Switzerland, right? Perfect, nothing is happening, nobody is being beaten, nobody is being attacked, it's wonderful. So I kept, you know, turning the channel back and forth between Al Jazeera and the Egyptian channel in disbelief, right? Are they talking about the same country, about the same place, about the same location, about the same people? This is just crazy, right? And this is because of autocratic governmental control over the media. Cracking down on foreign journalists, it was not uncommon for foreign journalists to be hit or attacked or harassed. We have seen incidents like, you know, Anderson Cooper being, you know, hassled by the thugs of the Mubarak regime in Cairo. Closing down the office of Al Jazeera in Cairo and detaining some of its own staff members, which again did not prevent the truth from coming out. Egyptians were able to find innovative ways, as always, to get around the state control and the cracking down and the closing down of the offices of Al Jazeera. Cutting off the cell phone lines for a few days, and I remember as an Egyptian how hard that was because I was not able to find out what was happening with my family. Back there, it was very difficult. No cell phones, no internet, nothing, complete blackout. Blocking off the internet for a whole week, pushing down the kill switch. Basically, we have a government that was using the mentality of the 50s and the 60s, and in the incident of the Camel battle, even using the mentality of, you know, the 12th century or before. Failed and incompetent political strategy coupled with an equally ineffective communication strategy is how I see it. In other words, the regime was equally incompetent and ineffective both politically as well as in the communication arena as well, which I think in the end led to its ultimate demise. On the other hand, the activists used very effective communication strategies. They deployed new social media, posting and chatting on Facebook, tweeting, blogging, and texting. They were not definitely riding camels and horses, that's for sure. They were much, much more into the 21st century technologically. Facebook became the people's book, and therefore some people called it the Facebook revolution, although I would share Zainab's position of taking this with reservation, because we don't want to overshadow the role of the actual players on the ground. Creating the missing link between mediated self-expression and street mobilization. In other words, between the virtual world and the real world. For a long, long time, we have been talking about the gap. In other words, people being very active in real life sometimes, but this does not lead into political change or does not lead to the actual overthrow of the regime or being active in opposition press, but not actually toppling over the regime. So it has been this kind of gap. Now we have the bridging of the virtual world and the real world and true mobilization of people on the ground. Finding alternative creative ways to access and spread information, they resorted to the speak-to-tweet service and used Hotbird instead of Nilesat to watch Al Jazeera. For those of you who do not know it, the speak-to-tweet was a service whereby even if you don't have internet connectivity, you can still dial a certain number and you can talk to Twitter, right? And you can just feed your message to them, verbally, and then this message will actually get turned into a tweet on Twitter. So this is a speak-to-tweet service to get around the governmental control and the governmental suppression and cutting off the internet connectivity and using Hotbird instead of Nilesat to access Al Jazeera when Al Jazeera, of course, was banned by the Egyptian government. So Egyptians have always been very innovative and very creative in finding ways. When people live in hardship, they become very creative. Find a way to cross the street without being killed in Cairo. It's awesome. Really, it has an excitement to it. You don't know it unless you come from this culture. I'm telling you. Just, pushing the button and crossing the street on time and very boring. No excitement there whatsoever. You're going to pass and you're not going to get killed. Where's the excitement? There's no fun. So Egyptians have been very, very creative and very innovative. This is what happens when people live in hardship. They find ways to really become creative and get around these hardships. The multiple roles of new media or social media in the Egyptian revolution, they were catalysts that paved the way for democratic transition and democratic reform, platforms for self-expression. People can express themselves openly and freely through these media platforms, channels for communication and organization, bridge builders between the young activists and their followers, between the virtual world and the real world, avenues for civic engagement and popular participation. In other words, the media are now turning from safety valves to mobilization tools. Many, many scholars who wrote about Arab media talked about the safety valve notion, i.e. opposition press being tame and benign, allowing a platform for people to express their anger so that, God forbid, they don't get angry enough to go out in the street and protest, which is eventually what happened in 2011. Arenas for a new form of citizen journalism, and citizen journalists, of course, played a very, very important role in the Arab Spring in general and in the Egyptian revolution in particular, as well as in other revolutions in the region, including the Syrian, of course, uprising. We have seen and are still witnessing examples of citizen journalists who are using the internet and social media very effectively in order to put across their messages and their images and to communicate to the rest of the world what is happening inside their own country and inside their own nation. So all of these were very important multiple roles played by social media in the context of the Egyptian revolution. So why youth leadership in particular? Why did I particularly focus on these two groups in my presentation, youth leadership and women's leadership in particular? Well, young people are the fastest growing segment of the population where reform is needed. In other words, the parts of the world where reform is much needed, this is the parts of the world that also have the fastest growing young population. In fact, 70% of the population in the Arab world fall in this category of young people. They're under 30 or under 35. They act as agents of change with their open-mindedness, desire for reform, creativity, energy, and determination. So they're really agents of change in every sense of the word. They're also very technologically savvy and comfortable with using the new media technologies and social media. And they were the main driving force behind grassroots movements and calls for change, such as the Kifaya or the Enough movement and the April 6th movement, which have been working on the ground for many years before the eruption of the Egyptian revolution, trying to bring about change and to convey a message to the president that he unfortunately did not listen to, which is enough, you've been there for 30 years, the country did not get any better, in fact, you have been suffering economically, politically, and socially, it is time for you to go. which unfortunately is not something that he responded to. So, many examples of youth leadership and youth activism. This young man, Wael Ghunim, you might have heard of him, and he was the young Google executive. He's Egyptian. He worked for Google, and he actually did play a role in terms of raising people's awareness and calling for action and movement. This is him addressing some of the protesters in the heart of Tahrir Square in Cairo, trying to mobilize people during the revolution. And together with another young man who is equally important but not as equally famous, his name is Abdulrahman Mansour, both of them helped to create the Facebook page We Are All Khalid Said, again, which Zainab has talked about this afternoon, so I will not repeat the story of Khalid Said because we already heard it, but definitely I agree with her that it did play a very, very important role in providing a platform for people to network and to mobilize and to organize their actions together in the real world to move forward with the revolution. Basically, the whole message was, if this happened to this young man, we will not allow it to happen to any of us again. Enough is enough. No more violations of human rights, no more torture, no more abuse, no more killing. And why women's leadership? Why is women's leadership particularly important to highlight also in the context of the Arab Spring and in the context of the Egyptian Revolution? Well, women played a very visible role in the Arab Spring. Many of them took part in non-stereotypical gender roles. In other words, they were not there just to nurture or nurse or support men who were actually on the front lines. Rather, they were very much on the front lines themselves, risking their own lives and facing very serious threats and risks such as injury, arrest, or even death. So they were really very much equal partners and equal players in the arena. They were not taking any marginalized or sidelined position. And when I say women, I mean all women, literally. Rich, poor, all my family went out. My mother was there. I was like amazed. I felt so, guilty about it, to be honest with you, just as a side note, because I was writing about it, but I did not live the moment with them. And that's something I think for the rest of my life, it will always haunt me, that I was not there in the middle of Tahrir Square, because I wish I was. I really wish I was. But everybody in my family, my mother in her 60s, my sisters, in their 30s, you name it, everybody, rich, poor, Muslim, Christian, veiled, face veiled, unveiled, everybody was saying, no to Mubarak, it's time for you to go. We are here to make our point and to pay the price for it if needed. And the selection of Tawakkul Karman, of course, who came to be known as the mother of the revolution in Yemen, as the very first Arab woman to actually be given the Nobel Peace Prize, signified international recognition for women's role in the Arab Spring movement. I see it as a nod by the international community in recognition of the role that women played in the midst of the Arab Spring. So this is an example again from Egypt, from the heart of Tahrir Square. You see this Egyptian woman who is holding this banner, and she has here a picture of Wael Ghunim, the young Google executive we just talked about a moment ago. And here is a sign that says, bring Wael Ghunim back alive, another victim of Mubarak's emergency law, who will be next? So this was when the Egyptian authorities actually arrested Wael Ghunim, and they detained him for 12 days. So this woman is actually taking action. She's going out. She's holding his picture, and she is saying, bring him back alive. And he's another victim of Mubarak's emergency law. Also, there are some very young opinion leaders. They emerge as very strong opinion leaders, both offline and online. One of them is Nawara Nigm, a prominent Egyptian blogger who used her blog and her Twitter account in order to spread political awareness and to mobilize young people behind the cause of ousting Mubarak and leading the way for political change. She happens to be a distant relative of mine, and I always envy her because she has hundreds of thousands of followers on her Twitter account versus my 35 followers, and I have to do something about it. I have to find a way to increase my visibility there on Twitter. Very ashamed. So she holds a banner here that says, a quotation from WikiLeaks, Omar Suleiman is Israel's first man after Mubarak. So she's trying to say, this is a WikiLeaks, this is a leak from WikiLeaks, and she's saying Omar Suleiman, of course, he is the now deceased vice president who was selected by Mubarak before he left office, is going to be Israel's first man after Mubarak, so he is not the right choice for the Egyptian people. Another very prominent activist who also played a very important role was Asma Mahfouz, this young Egyptian woman who actually posted her own vlog, so to speak. Young people, they come up with these new terminologies, right? And a vlog, of course, is a YouTube or video blog. You are blogging but using video, so they call it a vlog. So she had this very interesting vlog that she actually posted on YouTube, trying to call people to go out on January 25th, 2011. And it's a very, very powerful video, but I don't think we'll have time for it because I still have a lot of material to cover. But I strongly urge you to please go on your own on YouTube and Google for it and search for it and search for Asma Mahfouz vlog on January 25th, 2011, because it's very powerful. She talks about repression, she talks about corruption, she talks about the importance of going out in the street and taking action against the Mubarak regime. And most importantly, what is brilliant about this young woman, she used the gender stereotypes and twisted it around in a way that worked brilliantly. She literally said to young men, or men in general, if you are saying it is shame on you women and girls to go out in the street and protest, and you have no business being out in the street, why wouldn't you be man enough and come out in the street and protest and make your point and protect us and call for freedom and dignity? So she took the whole gender stereotype thing and turned it around and used it very brilliantly as a way to send the message across to mobilize everybody, including men, to come out and do something rather than doing nothing and complaining about women being out in the street inappropriately. So she made a great point. So please, you know, take a moment and watch this video because we don't have time for it this afternoon, unfortunately. All right. So I think there's a new concept of cyber feminism, which I think is emerging here. And this means actually referring to a process where women deploy new forms of communication, mainly online communication, to advocate for their own rights, causes, and demands, and to fight various forms of repression, discrimination, injustice against them. In my opinion, it can be considered a sister concept for the notion or the phenomena of cyber activism, which Philip Howard, 2011, actually defined as the use of online tools to advocate a cause which is difficult to advance offline. So whenever people use, you know, social media or new media to advocate for a certain cause online, which is difficult to advocate offline, this is called the process of cyber activism. And cyber feminism, in my opinion, is the sister of this particular process, where women actually use new media to advocate for their own causes and to fight repression and discrimination against them. It stresses the role of new media in serving the needs and the demands of women and helping women's causes. And in this regard, let me just say quickly that women did not just use the new media in order to fight for freedom and democracy like the fellow men. They did that, but they also have their own causes which are very special and specific to them as women. They are saying, we cannot be sidelined anymore. We cannot be marginalized anymore. Worse than that, we cannot accept harassment. We cannot accept, you know, virginity testing. We cannot accept rape. We cannot accept sexual harassment on the street. We cannot accept a woman like the woman who came to be known infamously as the blue bra woman, you know, who was exposed in the streets and all of that stuff. We cannot accept this to go on anymore. So they were also advocating for social causes, in my opinion, socio/political causes in the realm of the revolution and after the revolution. Three main functions, in my opinion, for this phenomena of cyber feminism: mobilization, rallying support for certain causes which are important for women, collecting the needed funds and securing the needed resources to help them. So let's do something about, for example, collect rape, which has been, unfortunately, a very tragic, massive problem in countries like Libya and Syria. I was talking to a Syrian activist the other day, and it's just something shocking, the amount of rape that's been going on and the amount of harassment against women. So there's been mobilization to do so, to raise awareness about these issues. Documentation, using their own cell phone cameras and their own digital cameras, and sometimes even pens and papers, to show the whole world incidents of brutality, humiliation, and harassment against women. So incidents where a woman would be harassed and her fellow, you know, or a demonstrator would be using her cell phone or her camera to record the incident and to put it on YouTube or blog about it, tweet about it, to raise awareness about these issues. And also education, raising awareness about women's issues and discussing them to increase their significance and their visibility in the public sphere. So there's been even things like Harass Map, where they actually create a website, they create locations where women are most likely or more likely to be harassed and put certain red spots around them so that women know that these areas are more likely they're more likely to be harassed if they go to these certain places, using social media in very innovative ways to bring about awareness, not just about political issues, but also about social issues that are important and particularly significant for women themselves. So, perceived opportunities. If we look at this picture of women's growing leadership, youth growing leadership, there are certainly certain positive opportunities. And there are also threats and there are also challenges, and we need to finish all of that in a few minutes. I don't know how, but we'll try. Okay, the perceived opportunities. Youth and women have a lot of opportunities to fight for their causes, spread their messages, and make their voices heard more than ever before. Social media provides youth and women with the needed window to see the rest of the world, but also to be seen by the rest of the world. So in other words, you're seeing the rest of the world, but also allowing the rest of the world to see you in a way which has been unprecedented before, as well as the needed tools to network, organize, and mobilize. The affordability, accessibility, interactivity, and immediacy of these different tools made them especially important in calling for socio-political change, i.e. not just political transformation, but also much-needed social reform. So you see this combination of factors. Social media allowing you to mobilize, to network, to open a window. You can see the rest of the world can see you. And at the same time, you're using all of that to bring about socio-political change and transformation. Also, the growing youth activism is especially important and relevant when it comes to supporting women's issues, since both youth and women could be perceived as two sides of the same coin of activism. So as one young activist put it to me, she said, women are riding the same car or the same wagon with youth. They're both the two sides of the same coin of activism. They're working hand in hand. And this is especially true, since many of the young activists who assumed leadership roles in the political arena before, during, and after the Egyptian revolution were women, such as Isra Abdel Fattah, who came to be known as the Facebook girl because of her prominent role in the April 6th movement and putting together its Facebook page. So because of her role in helping the April 6th movement and also helping to put together the Facebook page, she came to be known as the Facebook girl. And many other examples of young women like her who fit both categories. They're young and they're at the same time women. Unfortunately, it's not all roses, and there are some perceived threats and some perceived challenges at the same time. From solidarity to fragmentation, and this has been one of the greatest obstacles or challenges. After the great moment of unity and uniformity and solidarity that we have seen in the heart of Tahrir Square, Copts and Muslims holding hands, all different women together, wonderful. Now we do not see the very same spirit. There is now some kind of fragmentation. People have different agendas, they have different needs, they have different demands, and they don't always see things eye to eye. In my opinion, that is a healthy sign in itself, because before, everybody was repressed, everybody could not say, you know, their opinion, nobody was able to talk. So it's going to take time for things to go back in place and for some kind of orderly civic dialogue, if you will, to actually happen. But for now, we are seeing a cacophony of different voices, and we're seeing a lot of fragmentation. Lack of structure and organization, and that's applicable to both youth movements as well as women's movements. They still need time to be able to be better structured and more organized. The rise of political Islam, however, I would take this also with a grain of salt because I don't want to put all the Islamist groups in one single basket. There are different shades of Islamists. The Muslim Brotherhood, for example, which is now in charge in Egypt, has a much more moderate and reasonable agenda when it comes to women's issues and women's rights, and they allow women to run for political positions and so on, while some of the more conservative, orthodox, traditional Salafi groups have a much harsher and more difficult agenda that really kind of ousts women from the public sphere, which kind of bothers me. Okay, educational, economic, and infrastructure constraints. There are a number of economic, social, and infrastructure constraints in Egypt, as is the case in many parts of the so-called third world countries. Reactionary patriarchal culture, and that is not something that's going to change overnight. Changing the mindset or the culture takes years and years and years of hard work. That is still work that needs to be done. The creation of an unsafe public space for women, incidents like sexual harassment, violence, virginity testing, all of these things are very serious, and they can, if they keep going on, kind of discourage women from public sphere participation. But the good sign is they're aware of this, and they're very much fighting against it, both online and offline. The overshadowing and marginalization of women's issues, So the message is, as I like to put it, thank you, ladies. You have done your part. Now it's time to go back to the kitchen. Right? Okay? No, we have, you know, paid the price. We were there in the front lines fighting with you. We're about to be killed. You know, we have the right to claim a position in the public sphere just like you guys. Right? Uncertainties. The future of youth and women's leadership and the gains they can actually secure are very much related to the political and social future of their respective countries, many of which are now in a state of influx without a clear roadmap so far. So we are seeing all of these, you know, different changes in Egypt and other parts of the Arab world. Nobody knows where things are heading. If I told you, yes, I know exactly what's going to happen in Egypt tomorrow morning, I'd be lying to you. I really don't. I wish I do. This ambiguity is applicable in countries where the struggle for freedom is still ongoing, such as Bahrain and Syria, but it's also applicable in countries where, such as Egypt, Tunisia, and Libya, which are still facing many challenges after overthrowing their repressive regimes and ousting their dictators. So as I said earlier, the work is not done. It's not like, okay, we ousted the dictator, now it's time to, you know, go and get some sleep, or it's time to celebrate. There is still a lot of work that needs to be done, not just in countries fighting for freedom, like Syria or Bahrain, but even in countries that are now, quote-unquote, in a transitional phase, like Egypt, like Libya, like Tunisia. A lot of work needs to be done, because ousting a dictator from office is one thing, but figuring out what to do next is a much, much more difficult and much more important and critical challenge. And this is my last slide. Okay, we are doing well with time. I'm amazed. A final word, okay? In looking ahead, we have to bear in mind that it would be wise to adopt a realistic approach in looking at the future of youth and women's leadership in Egypt in the context of socio-political transformation, which acknowledges their gains and contributions, but also takes into account the challenges and threats that are confronting them. In other words, we have to be realistic. We cannot just overestimate and say, oh, everything is great, they have great opportunities, you know, the road is going to be paved for them with flowers, and they're going to achieve what they want. But at the same time, we don't want to be really very pessimistic and to overestimate the challenges and the obstacles that are confronting them either. In the same spirit, it would also be wise to use an approach of cyber realism, which actually avoids the two undesirable bipolar extremes of cyber pessimism or cyber optimism, which tend to underestimate or overestimate the role of social media in socio-political transformation. In other words, to be cyber realistic means to put everything in the right measure and the right check. Social media were important, they were catalysts, they were tools. They helped in networking, in mobilization, in bridging gaps, in bringing about change and paving the way for change. But, as we said earlier, they're not magical tools, and they cannot bring about transformation and political and social reform all by themselves. It's always the people themselves who have to pay the price and actually make this change happen. So the bipolar extremes of cyber optimism and overestimating the role of social media, thinking it's the Facebook revolution, the YouTube uprising, all of that stuff is not correct. And the cyber-pessimistic approach of saying, oh, we want to dismiss all of these technologies, they're not important, let's just forget about them, in my opinion, this is also not correct. We need to be balanced in our view of the role of social media in the process of socio-political transformation, and we also need to be balanced and realistic when it comes to the role of youth and women's leadership and activism in the context of the Egyptian revolution and in the broader context of the Arab Spring. They did play a very important and significant role and continue to do so and will continue to do so. They have a lot of great opportunities ahead of them, but they also have a lot of challenges and obstacles that they are facing. And at the end, it's going to be their will and it's going to be their decision. It's going to be their actions that's going to decide their future. Thank you very much.
We have about 10 minutes for questions before we'll take a break for coffee. And I do really recommend that you go to that Asma Mahfouz little clip. It's only 5 minutes. I showed it in my class the other day, and it's a very, very compelling piece of film. If you just Google Asma Mahfouz, M-A-H-F-U-Z, it comes up right away, actually. Okay, questions for Professor Khamis.
No questions. It must have been a boring presentation.
Hang on, there is one. Sorry, there's one over there. Carol.
I guess this touches upon your last point, but in a previous slide you discussed the role of social media as tools in giving a window in the world and also giving the world a window upon these women and the youth. You also said that they were tools that were necessary to interact, to organize and mobilize. To what extent do you think they're necessary? To what extent could women and youth have done the same things without social media?
Yeah, that's a good question and gets often asked because, you know, would the revolutions have taken place or happened had it not been for Facebook and Twitter and blogs? I think the short answer is yes, but the task or the job would have been much harder. It would have been much harder. It would have taken much more time because, as I mentioned, some of the movements like Kifaya movement or April 6th, they've been there and have been trying to work hard for many years. But because they were not able to do the kind of successful networking on the right scale, the right magnitude, at the right time, they did not really yield the same outcomes or the same results that we have seen in this particular wave of Arab Spring movements. So the short answer to your question is, yes, I think the revolution would have still taken place even without social media, but it would have been much harder, the task would have been much more daunting, and the organization would have been more difficult to achieve, and it would have taken a lot more time. So that would be the short answer to your question. Other questions?
Yes, I think it is a good question, and just to continue on this, but wasn't time one of the key elements of this revolution? You know, when I'm hearing you and also the previous talk, it seems to me that this, first of all, the acceleration that it enabled, the fact that quite immediately, you know, you could have the gathering of information, and also the fact that the people in power were not yet comfortable with these new media, so they had not learned yet how to react to it. It seems to me that we have like a historical moment where you have a unique, and it won't perhaps never be like that anymore, because now the people in power know how to react. So of course, it's better to say that the revolution would have taken place, but at the same time, I'm not quite sure that it would have been necessarily as successful, because time and the knowledge of these new media was really, really key. If it would have taken too much time, it would have deteriorated.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that you raise a very important point about the regimes in power, right, and the fact that they did not have prior, right, they were taken by surprise. They were totally taken by surprise in the case of Tunisia, in the case of Egypt and Libya, and they did not have the technological savviness and the skill to be able to use social media themselves. So the only thing they thought about was, okay, let's turn off the internet for a whole week, which, by the way, not only did Egyptians find a way to overcome this and get around it, but it even backfired. It created a counter effect because when people were not able to find their, you know, their friends and colleagues and so on social media and on the internet, they said, okay, people are in danger. We must have to go out in large numbers in order to protect each other, in order to give solidarity and help and support one another. So in a way, it was a failing and incompetent strategy that even backfired, that created a counter effect. But regimes also have their learning curves. Just like the activists and the protesters have their own learning curves and they learn with time and develop their skills, so does the autocratic regimes and dictators. So we have seen, for example, in Syria, the Syrian Electronic Army, which is an army, a group of protesters. They're not protesters. They are actually working for the Syrian regime, and they are a group of people who are helping the Syrian regime by following the protesters online, tracking them through the IP addresses, finding out where they are, and at the same time giving all of this information to the Syrian government. So they formed this Syrian Electronic Army. The regime formed it in order to keep track of the activists and their activities, which means that the regimes are increasing or improving their technological skills. So I agree with you totally. The element of timing is critical, and it did play an important role in the success of these revolutions. We are not sure if another revolution was to happen now, what would be the outcome, right? Yes?
Sorry.
Yes,
and then in that.
I wanted also to comment on that point, so it's not a question, because something else I read is that a huge factor, and we talk about social media, but they said that looking at revolutions across time, because they've happened before without social media, right? And there was the idea that because there was a 40% unemployment rate, so you have a very restless, young group that you were mentioning, and that's also one of the biggest triggers and revolutions from what I understood, that if you study across time, you have a high unemployment rate of those between 20 and 35. It's a trigger effect because they don't have anything. Mm-hmm. I don't know, they're restless, mm-hmm. and they want to change things so mm-hmm. they can work. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how that interacts.
Yeah, if I get your question right, you mean all of the factors that are at play in society?
Well, she was asking if it would yeah. still happen without social media, and mm-hmm. I agree with you, mm-hmm. yes, and some of the studies saying, mm-hmm. well, that's also because of this 40%
yes. oh, definitely.
Group
yeah. mm-hmm.
that
definitely.
Exists.
Yeah, I mean, for Egyptians, in the case of Egypt, 40% of the population lives under the international poverty line with less than $2 of income a day, right? Which is, you know, very poor. And, you know, these people do not have the kind of material wants and needs that they need. They don't have the jobs. They don't have employment. So all of these are factors that definitely played into the rage and the anger. But the social media, again, were catalysts that helped to organize and mobilize the protests and to make them happen effectively. And the element of timing also, I agree, was a critical factor in the mix. But the reasons or the causes are still there. The unemployment, the poverty, the economic suffering, all of these factors are still there. They did not go away. They did not vanish 2 years after the revolution, unfortunately.
We have time for one more question, I think. Yes,
go ahead. I don't know if you heard this morning that Shukri Beled in Tunisia was killed in close range. I think he was shot in the head 7 times or so, and he's the leader of the opposition party in Tunisia. And so all day there's been massive uprisings, and I think they're going to hold elections again or something like this. And so I just wanted to hear, and I think so Salafis are being said that they're behind this, and I just wanted to hear more of your views about the sort of the Islamist influences. And I know, like in Tunis, for example, it's and Nahda won the elections, but that they were financed largely by Qatar. And so it seems to me that this is sort of the biggest threat to these burgeoning democracies. And I wonder what you think about that and what the people can kind of do about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's again a question that always gets asked about the rise of political Islam. And I think I touched on it quickly in the presentation, but I think the bottom line here is we cannot put all of the Islamist groups in one single, you know, group, one single basket, because there are so many different shades. I think of it as a spectrum. So you have a large spectrum. A group like the Muslim Brotherhood, for example, has a relatively moderate agenda when it comes to women's issues, when it comes to, you know, tolerance of the other opinion, opposition, and so on. The same could not be said equally of all the other Islamist groups, some of which do have some very orthodox, traditional, or conservative interpretations, and some of which I would be more worried about if they were in power because of their agendas on issues like women's rights, women's prevalence in the public sphere, or, you know, freedom of expression and opposition and all of that stuff. So I think the bottom line is we just need to recognize that there isn't a single quote-unquote Islamist group, just like there isn't a single Islamist resurgence movement or re-Islamization. There is a big, big, big spectrum, and we just have to be sensitive to the diversity and the varieties within this spectrum. So I don't want to, you know, to oversell the idea, you know, of Islamophobia and fear of anything or everything that is quote-unquote Muslim or Islamist, because it's simply not true. But at the same time, that is not to say that there is no fear whatsoever and the picture is rosy and flowery. And no, it is not like that. It's just like we want to take, you know, social media with a balance of realism. The same thing could be said about political Islam. We also need to see it in a balanced and in a realistic context that does not, you know, fear too much from some of the groups or underestimate the danger of other groups. There's a question here from an Egyptian journalist. She had her hand up, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure. Okay, yes. We can finish, yes. finish that question.
Professor Zahar, what is compelling now is to build the structures, because I'm Egyptian too, and we lived the last years in a neoliberalism and context of liberal economies that made a retreat of the state from the fundamental needs of the people, and the civil society take the turn to undertake people needs. So as you are aware of feminist works, what can be the role of women ONGs and civil society to fund, because there is a need of funds mm-hmm. To enhance and foster unfolding structural buildings in Egypt.
Yeah, definitely. The role of civil society or civic society has been a major gap or a major, you know, void in Egypt for a long, long time, because when you have repressive regimes and autocrats, they don't really allow the civil society to prosper or to grow. And this has been a major deficiency and one of the reasons why there has not been a transition or a call for democratization and reform even, you know, earlier on a much, much massive and much larger scale, because definitely the civil society has been handicapped by the corruption and the autocracy of the regime in power. There is definitely a need for structure, organization, networking, funding for different groups. Young activists, like, you know, these young activists we've been talking about this afternoon, they need to get their action together. They're complaining about, oh, we are being sidelined by the regime, we don't have a voice, we have paid the price, but, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood took power. Well, there is a reason for that. The Muslim Brotherhood, despite the, you know, repression that they were suffering from for a long, long time, they were very, very organized on the ground, and they were able to reach out to people very effectively and to offer services and to reach out to poor people and give them, you know, a lot of support. Something that the youth, you know, movement and women movement did not really succeed so far in doing. So I put high hopes, or I hope, that they will be able to provide certain structures, organization, be able to really get themselves organized, reach out to people, offer, you know, key and critical services, reach out for funding both internally and externally if needed, get their action together both online and offline, so that hopefully in coming elections they will have much, much more weight in the political process and hopefully be able to gain power in the rising and transitional Arab societies.
Thank you very much, Professor.